Case number 13-1596 et al. Sami Abdulaziz Alaifi, appellant versus Donald H. Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, Department of Defense et al. Mr. Cohen for the appellant, Ms. Foster for the appellees.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Russell Cohen. I represent the appellants in this matter. Mr. Chelengush, Mr. Mert, Mr. Sen, Mr. Hassam, Mr. Muhammad, and Mr. Alaifi. I would like to focus this morning on the district court's determination that each of the defendants were acting within the scope of their employment with respect to plaintiffs' international law claims. That determination was an error because the facts, as alleged in the complaints, are that defendants continued to detain, continued to abuse, and continued to target the religious practices of plaintiffs, even after three of the plaintiffs had been determined not to be enemy combatants. Each of the plaintiffs were held at Guantanamo, and each of the plaintiffs alleged that they were abused there. But three of the plaintiffs, Mr. Hassam, Mr. Muhammad, and Mr. Alaifi, were determined in combatant status review tribunals not to be enemy combatants. Now, the district court below determined that that determination was a distinction without a difference, that determining that they were not enemy combatants was a distinction without a difference as to those who had been determined or had not been yet determined, those who were suspected enemy combatants. But I would submit that it is a distinction with the greatest of significance. Now, as you know, the CSRT process was a flawed one. It was a biased process, as the Supreme Court determined in the Bamidian case. But nevertheless, these three plaintiffs were found not to be enemy combatants. Now, once that determination was made, we submit that the job of those who are responsible for the detention of these individuals changed. The job was no longer as it was in the Rasul case, the detention and interrogation of suspected enemy combatants. The job was to arrange for the expeditious release of these individuals who were determined not to be enemy combatants.
The defendants or the plaintiffs in the Rasul case were released, correct?
The plaintiffs in the Rasul case were released, yes, Your
Honor. In 2004.
Correct.
Before the Combat Status Review Tribunal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But to be in Guantanamo, they had to have been, at one point, determined to be enemy combatants.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record here to suggest...
No, I'm talking about Rasul.
In Rasul, I don't believe there's anything in the decision that says they were determined on the battlefield or anywhere else to have been enemy combatants.
But to be released, they had to be determined not to be enemy combatants, I would assume.
Well, Judge Randolph, I don't believe there was any determination with respect to those individuals, at least a CSRT determination. There was
because the tribunal wasn't in existence. But what I'm wondering is whether, did you go back? I haven't. And check the complaint in Rasul to see whether there was an allegation that by those plaintiffs that they were not enemy combatants?
I have not gone back and checked that, Your Honor.
Okay.
But in this case, these three plaintiffs, Mr. Hassam, Mr. Muhammad, and Mr. Alaifi, were affirmatively determined by the CSRT not to be enemy combatants. That was a determination that took place in December of 2004. They weren't even advised of that until May of 2005. And in fact, Mr. Muhammad refused to participate in a CSRT determination because it wouldn't receive evidence that he was a refugee.
But was the allegation that the tribunal made its decision in December of 2004, or was it that the hearing was held in December 2004?
The complaint alleges that the hearing was held in December 2004.
Right. But there's nothing in the complaint that I've seen that tells us when the decision was made.
There is nothing that says when the decision was made, the individuals were advised of it in May of 2005. But the crux of the claim, Your Honor, is that notwithstanding the hearing in December, being advised of the decision in May, Mr. Alaifi continued to be held until October of 2005. Mr. Hassam and Muhammad continued to be held until November of 2006.
Which ones went to Albania?
Mr. Hassam and Muhammad.
Okay. What was their native country? Where were they citizens?
So one was a Uzbek refugee, and one was an Algerian refugee.
So they were both refugees, not to be sent back to their native country?
That's correct, Your Honor. The allegations, however, is that notwithstanding the length of the detention post-CSRT, they also continued to be abused during that period. They continued to be treated as if they were suspected enemy combatants, and their religious practices continued to be aggressively targeted. Now, we would submit that on the basis of these facts that are alleged in the complaint, it is plausible that defendants were acting outside of the scope of their employment in continuing to detain, in continuing to abuse, and in continuing to target the religious practices of those determined not to be enemy combatants.
Don't you need to allege at least some basis on which they would be acting on their own?
Well, Your Honor, what is alleged is that individuals received CSRT determinations. And as I submit, that changes the job of those who are responsible for the detention of those individuals. And we have alleged that post-determination, they were detained for between 10 months and 2 years, that they continued to be treated as if they were enemy combatants, and they continued to have their religious practices targeted. I would submit that those facts make plausible a claim that the individuals who are holding them were not acting within the scope of their employment. They weren't acting to facilitate the expeditious release of these individuals. They were acting outside the scope. They were acting, whether because of personal animus, they were acting for whatever reason, Your Honor, but it was inconsistent with the job, which was to facilitate their expeditious release.
They were segregated after the tribunal's determination, correct?
Yes, it's alleged in the complaint that they were moved to Camp Iguana, and I would submit, Your Honor, that that shows that the military understood that these individuals should be treated differently. And the fact that they weren't underscores the point I'm trying to make today, which is that the individuals who were treating them, or mistreating them rather, during this post-CSRT period, understood that these individuals should have been treated differently, understood that their job was to facilitate their transfer. Yet nevertheless, they continued to abuse them and they continued to target their religious practices.
As far as the, apart from religious practices, the allegation I take, and I'm just looking at to get a feel for this, Mr. Muhammad, on page 75 of the Joint Appendix, he says, after he was classified as a non-enemy combatant, he was subject to a search of his body, and his wrists and ankles were shackled, and sometimes forced to wear blackened goggles. Is that it? That's the mistreatment you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, and it continues in the following paragraph.
Now that's the religious part of it. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Now, it may be, Your Honor, that when all the facts are in, the government has an explanation for these practices. It's prison management. It was prison discipline. These were necessary steps in order to manage the facility. But those are all factual issues. Those are issues that can't be determined as a matter of law. At this stage, the facts that are alleged must be taken as true. And based on the facts that are alleged, it is plausible that these individuals were acting outside of the scope.
What's your response to the government's Iqbal argument?
Your Honor, I would submit that the complaint, as drafted, contains sufficient facts to make these claims plausible. They contain the facts regarding the CSRT determinations for these detainees. They contain the facts regarding their prolonged detention after the determination. They contain the facts regarding the abuse after the CSRT determination. And they contain the facts regarding the religious targeting. And as to the defendants, it's alleged that the defendants played a role in establishing the detention and condition, the detention conditions for these individuals.
On the prolonged allegation of prolonged determination, how do we evaluate that? You yourself said that in the post-tribunal phase, the government's responsibility was to transfer or release, right? Which obviously, in fact, you concede in your brief that that takes time. How do we know that this was excessive?
Well, one thing we can look to, Your Honor, is what Justice Kennedy said in the Rasool case, where he said where we're talking days or weeks, that's one thing. Where we're talking months, years, that's a different thing. Now, obviously, this is a different context, but that gives us a way to think about this. Here, we're talking about months and years. And this is a complaint that doesn't just allege prolonged detention post-CSRT. It also alleges abuse.
So I just have two technical questions about your complaint. One is, as you said, the heart of your distinction of this case from Rasool is that this is post-tribunal determination, right?
That's correct. Okay.
So, and I went through the complaint pretty carefully, and several of these defendants don't seem to have been serving during that period of time. Leonard, Dunleavy, Miller, Carrico, McLean, Cannon. So, I couldn't find any. The other defendants I found sufficient allegations to indicate that they were serving during that time, but not those. What do we do with that?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that as to those defendants who served during an earlier period, they established policies and practices that were carried over to the post-CSRT period.
Is there I didn't see an allegation about that.
Your Honor, if there's a concern about that issue, that's certainly something that we could take up before the district court. It's something that could be addressed.
Well, we're essentially functioning like a district court here, right? We're de novo. We're looking at this completely de novo. We are essentially a district court at this stage. The question is whether the complaint is adequate.
At this stage, Your Honor, I would submit that it can be inferred from the complaint that it's plausible based on the allegations of the complaint that some of the policies and practices that were put in place in the pre-CSRT period applied in the post-CSRT period. But if Your Honor finds that the complaint does not adequately allege it, we would request the opportunity to amend that and make more sufficient those allegations.
Yeah. So my other question is, for one of the post-tribunal plaintiffs, Alahi?
Alafi, yes.
Alafi.
Yes.
The other two, Mohammed and who was the other one?
Mr. Hassan.
Yeah, Hassan. The complaint does allege specific acts in that period between the tribunal determination and their release. But this third one, I couldn't find. I mean, his allegations are quite strong, but I didn't see any allegation, any indication that those acts occurred during that critical period of time.
You're correct, Your Honor. What the complaint says is that he was held for the 10-month period following the determination. And again, that is something that...
But these allegations aren't... You can't tell from the complaint whether these allegations relate to that period of time or to the period of time, the allegations about abuse, deprivation of religious rights. I can't tell from the complaint when they occurred.
I agree, Your Honor. With respect to Mr. Alathi, it is not specifically described as post-CSRT activities.
So what do we do with that?
That's, again, something that, with the court's permission, we could amend and add additional facts to make more sufficient those allegations.
Uh-huh.
But the complaint does allege, as to Mr. Alathi, that he was held for a period of 10 months following the CSRT.
Yes, that's your duration claim.
Correct.
I got that. Okay. Yeah, I understand that. Okay. Do you have other questions? Right? Anything else?
Your Honor, I would just refer this court to the Mahano case, the D.C. Circuit case in which the court determined that an employee was not acting within the scope of their employment, although they initially began a course of conduct when
What were the facts? That wasn't the hockey player, was it?
That was not the hockey
which
player.
Was
that
this?
Was the Smithsonian.
Oh,
it was the employee
Smithsonian.
Trying to gain
oh,
access to the Smithsonian.
Yeah, right.
They pushed their way in.
Right, okay.
The court held that was within the scope of employment. You were trying to gain access to work. But after that, there was a pause. The employee walked down a hallway and then came back and tore the lanyard off the person who had attempted to obstruct their access. The court said that was not acting within the scope of employment. At that point, you had stepped outside and you were no longer trying to accomplish the goals. I would submit that this is a case in which, although we had an earlier period, as described in the Rasool case, where the defendants may have been acting within the scope, it's at least plausible at this point that they stepped outside of that scope with respect to those plaintiffs who were determined not to be enemy combatants.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing. I hadn't focused on the point that one of the points that Judge Tatel just made. Is there any allegation that, with respect to these three gentlemen, that they were interrogated after the CSRT decision? Because I've just been looking and hadn't focused on that, and I don't see that.
There's no specific allegation that they were interrogated by Americans post-CSRT. There is an allegation that one of the plaintiffs was interrogated by Algerians post-CSRT. And I would also point out that in the complaint, it is alleged that one of the aggressive interrogation techniques that had been recommended to Defense Secretary Rumsfeld at an earlier point was the removal of religious objects. And one of the post-CSRT allegations with respect to these plaintiffs is that religious objects were removed. Their Qurans were removed. So there is no clear allegation of post-CSRT interrogation, but I would point to those facts in the complaint.
Do you think that, is it your theory that that non-abusive interrogation would be inappropriate post-CSRT?
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
Why is that?
Because these individuals were determined not to be enemy combatants.
Right, but they still might have useful information.
Well, Your Honor, at that point, the goal is to release them and not to continue to interrogate them. At that point, they are determined not to be enemy combatants. There is no further authority to hold them. And while I understand there may be steps involved in transferring them, at that point, there really is no reason to continue to hold, interrogate. Mm-hmm. Everything at that point changes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Sydney Foster for the defendants. Mm-hmm. Your Honors, the proper focus for the scope of employment inquiry is on what the defendants, the named defendants, were specifically alleged to have done here and whether that matches up with what their jobs were. And here there's certainly a clear match, as the district court found. What the defendants are alleged to have done here, and the allegations are at JA 77 to 81 and 115 to 19, are they're alleged to have done things like issuing policies concerning interrogations, requesting permission to use particular interrogation techniques, and then simply exercising command and control over certain aspects of the military. That's precisely what these defendants were employed to do, and their actions
are challenged. You're talking now about the allegations against the upper-level employees, the named defendants, right?
Right. The substitution was with respect to only the named defendants, and that's all.
But there's many other specific allegations here. I'm looking at paragraph 177. The defendants were aware, should have been aware, that plaintiffs were subject to torture, cruel, and inhumane treatment. Defendants, quote, took no steps to prevent infliction of torture. Paragraph 178, defendants authorized, mandated, condoned, and failed in their command structure to prevent infliction and abuse. Paragraph, I go on and on. Defendants are aware, should have been aware, torture, cruel, these are very specific allegations about the named defendants.
Well, I don't know that I'd go so far as to say that they're very specific. They actually seem a little bit general to me, but the
what is general about that?
They don't identify specifically what, for example, the named defendants were aware of, what specific facts.
But you have all of the other allegations regarding the specific plaintiffs, desecration of Qurans, removal of Qurans, interruption with religious activities, grooming, forced shaving. You have to look at these together. What you need to explain to me is why, when you combine those two sets of allegations, that is, the plaintiff's allegations about how they were treated, plus their allegations about the named defendants and their responsibility for this, explain to me why that isn't sufficient.
Okay. I'd just like to note that I don't think we know that the named defendants, for example, were aware of the particular conduct that was alleged with respect to the particular plaintiffs here.
We're at the motion to dismiss stage. That's all. It's not summary judgment. It's motion to dismiss. And I mean, the standard is, keep in mind what the standard is. Okay, I'm quoting here. We can only affirm a dismissal if the facts, allegations taken as true in the complaint, it appears, quote, beyond doubt that plaintiffs can prove no set of circumstances under which they could proceed. Beyond doubt. So I'm asking this because I read your brief, and you quote all the language about, generic conclusory allegations aren't sufficient. But explain to me why these aren't specific enough to satisfy the pleading standards at this point.
I'll answer that question in a second, but I'd also just like to note that even if these were somehow specific enough, mm-hmm. the defendants still would be acting within the scope of their employment, because what you've referenced are allegations about kind of what the defendants should have done in their capacities as individuals charged with running the detention facility at Guantanamo. The defendants are alleged to have failed to take action that they should have taken to stop the alleged abuses here.
But this is post-CSERT.
That's right.
These are not enemy combatants, and the plaintiff's allegations about that are, is it at this stage, when you look at scope of employment, you have to look at the underlying function here, and the underlying function at this point in the proceedings was to transfer or release.
I would say the underlying function was to continue their detention pending their transfer to another country.
Continue.
But that also includes maintaining security and order at the detention facility and so forth.
That's true, but what about the allegations about desecration of the Quran, removal of the Quran, forced grooming, interference with religious activities, mocking religious activities? How do those fit into that?
I think there are two answers, Your Honor. One is that the mistreatment that is specifically alleged to have occurred after the CSERT determinations, and I think Your Honor pointed out that the only Hassam and Muhammad specifically alleged that any mistreatment took place.
Right, but that's two of the three.
Right. My point is, though, that we need to look at those specific allegations, and that's at J7980 and 117. And none of the named defendants here are alleged to have engaged in the misconduct that is the issue.
Because you're segregating the parts of the complaint. Of course they are alleging that the Secretary of Defense or senior military officials themselves desecrated a Quran. Their allegations are that they knew or should have known about it, or they affirmatively condoned it. That's their allegation. They're not claiming that they did it themselves.
Well, Your Honor, even if those allegations are specific enough, again, then the contention is that the defendants weren't doing their jobs of stopping abuse that shouldn't have been happening after the CSERT process. It's quintessentially within the scope of the defendant's employment to, you know, that they are not doing their jobs. That's, you know, the restatement 232 comment C says specifically that a failure to engage in action that an individual has a duty to engage in is fundamentally within the scope of employment. So even if you think that those allegations are sufficiently specific, they're still alleging that the defendants were engaged in conduct or action or inaction that was fundamentally within the scope of their employment.
Why, I know we held in Rasul that District of Columbia law applied to determine the scope of employment. Why is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I'll note that, I mean, no one here is disputing that the DC law applies. So, okay. I think, you know, this court has held that where the employment relationship exists is kind of the proper focus.
Where is the employment relationship here? Is it through the Department of Defense?
I think that's right, and I think that's
That's in Virginia.
That's right. So it's possible Virginia law could also be applicable. Virginia law has a similar.
And when you talk about the servant master, who's the master?
I think, Your Honor, the master here is the United States, led by, you know, the commander-in-chief, which is the president.
The president. Okay. So the president's located in D.C.
The president's located in D.C. A lot of the defendants here are high-level defendants, including former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, who, you know, would have had a lot of his work connected very strongly to D.C., even though his office is located at the Pentagon in Virginia.
Okay. And your position is the Federal Tort Claims Act doesn't apply to Guantanamo, right?
Our position is that acts that rise out of Guantanamo are barred by the foreign country exception. That is correct.
Let me take you back to the discussion you and I were having about the supervisory employees. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, your point is that their alleged failure to prevent abuse was acting within the scope of employment because their job was to prevent abuse. Did I hear you correctly?
That's right. Okay. That's right, Your Honor.
So I have to think about that, but. Let me ask you about paragraph 183 of one of the complaints. These are the allegations about the Secretary of Defense.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Which talks about a April 2003 where the Secretary of Defense issued a set of recommended techniques requiring his express approval for four specific techniques, one of which was removal of religious items.
Correct.
So here you have an allegation that one of the supervisory defendants is alleged to, this isn't a question of supervision at all, it's just a question of direct responsibility, authorizing the removal of religious items.
Right, but Your Honor, I mean, this allegation here says that Secretary Rumsfeld recommended the use of these techniques as interrogation methods. That's quintessentially within the scope of his employment.
But this is post-CSERT.
I don't think that changes anything. Like, A, we don't know. Actually, this is before CSERTs were even established, so we don't know at all that these policies continue to apply to the individuals who are detained in a segregated facility, as Your Honor noted, after their CSERTs had concluded that they were no longer enemy combatants. There's no allegation in the complaint that adequately contends that that's the case. Even if it were so, the defendants here were charged with managing a military detention facility, maintaining security and order at that detention facility during the period where the plaintiffs were detained pending their transfer to another country, and any decisions that the defendants made about conditions of confinement, treatment, and so forth was plainly a part of their job, or at least incidental to their authorized conduct.
I thought your short answer would be, we've already decided that question.
Well, that's right. I think the rationale...
Russell 1 took up allegations that were basically the same and rejected them.
That's exactly right. And we don't think that the fact that that these detainees were determined by CSIRT to no longer be enemy combatants somehow then takes the same exact same conduct out of the scope of employment.
Well, what are you
during
doing
that?
With
Can I just follow up? Do you know whether the complaint in Rasul 1 alleged that the plaintiffs were not enemy combatants?
I don't know if it specifically alleged that. I believe that the decision certainly characterizes the complaints as having alleged, that the individuals were, on innocent missions, when they were detained and so forth, which would suggest
And they were released. So one would suppose that there's no indication, at least in the opinion, that some of the Guantanamo detainees were released to their home country and then subjected to detention there, but I don't see that, and I also note that in the opinion, I sat on the case and I don't remember the details, but in the opinion it says that these plaintiffs were certainly free to have filed a claim with the government under the Tort Claims Act after they were released, so I assume they weren't in detention in Algeria or in Egypt.
The plaintiffs here?
No, the plaintiffs in Rasul.
Oh, that could be. Yes, I don't know. I don't know.
What do you make of going back to your point that this case is controlled by Rasul? What do you make of the fact that the Rasul court at least three times emphasized that the actions there were related to the interrogation and treatment of enemy combatants?
Your Honor, I think that the reason that the court characterized used that characterization is because that's simply what was before the court at that time. But I think if you look at the court's rationale for reaching its conclusion, and in fact if you look at other language in the opinion where the court notes that the management by the officials there was within the scope of their employment because they were managing plaintiff's detention. This is a quote, plaintiff's detention in a military prison and the interrogations conducted therein. That's the more general language.
It says where high-level military officials are charged with crimes of war and terror and specifically with interrogating suspected terrorists. And then it even specifically says the underlying conduct here is the detention and interrogation of suspected enemy combatants.
You're right, Your Honor. I don't think, though, that the court was, by using that language, was intending to limit its decision fully to that context. The rationale...
Why?
Reading
the language from the opinion. I have nothing to go on, but I wasn't on the panel, but I don't see anything in there other than that. But
Your Honor, the rationale for the opinion was that the conduct that was alleged was the defendant's management supervision of detention policies at Guantanamo. And it's true that those were with... That's right. It was with respect to those who were... had not been determined by CSIRT's, had not gone through a CSIRT process. They were suspected enemy combatants or perhaps enemy combatants. That's absolutely right. But the reason that the court held that the defendant's actions were within the scope of employment there was because the alleged conduct, the detention of the individuals who claimed to be innocent, the mistreatment of those individuals, was at least incidental to the defendant's jobs, which was to manage the detention facility at Guantanamo. The defendant's jobs, still after the CSIRT determination...
Okay, I understand your argument about that. I suppose an answer would be that, well, if that's what the court had meant, it wouldn't have three times limited it to alleged suspected enemy terrorists. But let me move on to a different question regarding the detainees' allegation that Rasool is different for a second reason, which is that Rasool dealt only with the first factor, the first restatement factor. It didn't deal at all with the third factor, that is motivation. And in fact, as they point out, Rasool itself said there's no allegation in this case about rogue employees pursuing their own personal vendettas, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So in your brief at page 43, the government's brief, you've got two paragraphs responding to this allegation, okay? And by the way, just this whole paragraph is all aimed at the named defendants.
That's correct.
What about the Doe defendants?
The Doe defendants are not at issue in this case anymore. The substitution was with respect to the named defendants, and so that's the only the defendants that are at issue with respect to this Westfall Act substitution question.
Okay. You say your first sentence is that they don't address the named defendants, right? That's one thing.
Well, they address three of the named defendants specifically on JA 6. I think it's 79-80 and 117. That's specific allegations about Rumsfeld and Dunleavy and Miller. But that's the only specific allegations with respect to the named defendants.
Okay. So the government's position is that any allegation that's aimed at all of the defendants, named defendants, is insufficient because it doesn't name which one? Is that your point?
It would depend on the allegation. I mean, I think the other allegations that are at issue here are allegations that all of the defendants, did very general acts. The allegation that we point to that we do think is insufficient, plainly insufficient under Iqbal, is the allegation that all of the defendants had the intent to approve these particular methods because of animus towards the plaintiff's religion. Uh-huh. That's the kind of allegation that simply does not pass muster.
Okay,
under
you and I, right? You and I have talked about that. So then you say the plaintiff's allegations, the detainees' allegations themselves, were sufficient to show that the defendants were serving the master, right? And you cite three things there. Two are from paragraph 182 of the complaint. This is about defendant Dunleavy getting permission and another Rumsfeld memo, right?
Right.
Okay, but both of these are pre-C-cert.
Right.
These don't deal with the post-C-cert period, which is what these plaintiffs are focused on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, they're the only specific allegations, which is why we focus on those, yes.
Okay, but you see that they're not related to the period of time there.
I agree that they're not related to this period of time.
And then your third statement was a bit of a mystery to me. Maybe you can explain it, which is you cite paragraph 185, that Myers possessed and exercised control over Guantanamo. So what's the significance of that?
Well, Your Honor, our point was that the other allegations that are general in nature, that maybe cover all the defendants or that cover a specific defendant but are very general, such as the allegations that, particular defendants exercise command and control over, particular aspects of the military, that those allegations also support the conclusion that the intention here for the defendants was at least in part to serve the master. Because the only thing that the defendants are alleged to have done here is either things that are clearly within their job description, such as approving interrogation techniques and so forth, or failing to take action that they're allegedly supposed to have taken, such as taking action to stop mistreatment and so forth. That's also plainly within their job description, and that's the question that's before this court, is whether or not the allegations of the defendant's conduct show that the defendants were acting beyond the scope of their employment. There's simply no plausible allegations in this complaint that would suggest that the defendants had the sole purpose of some kind of personal animus or some kind of purpose that was divorced from the purpose of the master. That all the allegations address kind of what the job responsibilities were, and that raises the inference that the defendants were intending to serve at least in part their master, and that principle is recognized too in the case law, the D.C. Case laws, including like the cases like Johnson and so forth.
Okay, thank you. Oh, did you have any other questions? No. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cohen, I think you used up, did you use up all his time? Yeah, you can have 2 minutes. And I'm going to use up a bit of your time by asking you to respond to Ms. Foster's point here that the named defendants were acting within the scope of their employment because part of their job was to prevent abuse, and their failure to do so was still within the scope of their employment.
Well, I would answer you this way, Your Honor, that once the determination that these plaintiffs were not enemy combatants is made, then the job changes. The job is to ensure their expeditious transfer.
No, that's not my question. I understand that. I think her point is, even assuming you're right about that, their job is to protect the detainees and to protect them from abuse. And that's within the scope of their employment, and their failure to do so is still within the... That's her argument, isn't it? Is that what you heard?
Well, that's what I heard, Your Honor.
The answer to that?
I would explain it as follows, that once you have a determination that they're not enemy combatants, your job is to ensure that there are procedures in place for their swift transfer out of Guantanamo. And to the extent you have failed to do so, and to the extent there are practices in place, such as removing religious items, practices that are used as aggressive interrogation techniques on suspected enemy combatants, then it is at least plausible that you are acting outside of the scope, that you're failing to act within the scope of your responsibility wherever you are in that chain of command, ensuring that those detainees...
What laws violated by the removal of a Koran?
Well, at that point, Your Honor...
Is that considered torture under the Torture Victims Protection Act of 1991?
I wouldn't characterize it that way, Your Honor. I would characterize that as being a factor to consider in whether these defendants were acting within the scope of their employment. When they are removing a Quran from non-enemy combatants, and it cannot be justified as an aggressive interrogation technique at that point, then there is an argument, at least, that they are acting with personal animus. And if they are acting with personal animus, they are acting outside of the scope of employment.
But let's suppose that the only allegation in your complaint was after they were determined not to be enemy combatants, and while the United States was doing whatever it was doing to arrange their release, that a guard removed a Quran from one of these individuals. What law would that violate?
Well, we have a guard removing a Quran from an individual who's being detained for a period of up to 2 years after he has been determined not to be an enemy combatant. Well, in those circumstances,
don't tamper with the hypothetical. Okay. Just what law does that violate? That's all. And I'm just asking that hypothetically because I'm having a hard time seeing what law violates.
We've alleged these complaints under international law that this would be cruel and inhuman treatment to withdraw the Quran, and when viewed in conjunction with the prolonged detention and the additional abuse, we would submit that it would be cruel and inhuman treatment.
Under what?
International law as made actionable under the ATS.
So that presents a whole range of problems, and I thought that's what your answer would be. If a United States citizen sued and said that somebody in the federal government removed my Bible from my hotel room with a warrant or whatever, and all complicated, they couldn't bring an action saying international law, I get damages because international law makes that illegal. So if that's the case, and I am 100% positive it is the case, then why is it that an alien bringing such a lawsuit for such an activity in a country that is not part of the sovereign territory of the United States has a cause of action?
Well, I don't want to question your hypothetical, Your Honor, but again, this is not just an allegation of taking the Quran. It's the allegation of taking the Quran from an individual who had been detained at Guantanamo at that point for more than 4 years and in total stayed there for a total of 6 years, that had been determined not to be an enemy combatant, and that allegation is made alongside allegations that there was also physical abuse. So when all of that is taken together, I would submit that that is a violation of international law that would be actionable under the ATF. And at this stage, the only question is whether it makes out a plausible claim, and I submit that it does.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.